Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So you start out with a fresh cheese, and then you end up with these hundreds of varieties of cheese. And a lot of that has to do with the microbes that are growing on the surface.
Microbiologist Rachel Dutton studies microbes on cheeses. She'll tell us how these little bugs impart flavor and why what the cow eats is important to how a cheese looks. Carrots with farmer Jim Lewis, and carrots in a stew with Chef Daniel Orr. And then urban farming pioneer Will Allen visited Indiana University's campus garden recently. He said he's seeing more and more young people wanting to grow food in these communal urban settings. A great conversation with him in the second half of the show. The week's news, first off, GMOs, organics, and wild foods. Luann Johnson has three stories for us from across the food spectrum.
This week, Vermont passed a law that would make it the first state to require labeling of foods made with genetically modified organisms. The state Senate approved the bill with a 28-2 vote. The state House of Representatives has already passed the bill. Vermont's bill differs from bills passed in Connecticut and Maine, as it doesn't contain a clause that requires other states to pass similar measures. For now, in Vermont, the bill goes back to the House to pass the edited bill. If the House approves, it will become law July 1, 2016. News last week that Walmart is partnering with the Wild Oats brand to provide organic products at lower prices has been met with some skepticism. Initially, the demand for organic ingredients to create the olive oil, tomato products, and applesauce that Wild Oats produces will drive up prices. If the line takes off, the move could eventually drive organic prices down. For organic farmers to meet demand, farmers could implement industrial organic practices, potentially diluting the sustainability of organic farming. Organic products typically cost more, not because of a premium, but because organic farmers don't receive subsidies like conventional farms. Currently, demand for organic foods far outstrips production in the United States by about 25%. And with the arrival of spring, Indiana mushroom hunters are starting to forage for the prized morel mushroom, and this year they're allowed to roam deeper into the woods without violating the law. Previous state law required mushroom hunters to stay on trails when foraging in state parks. Now they can go off the trails. Ginger Murphy is the assistant director for stewardship with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources and says most mushroom hunters have been going off trails for some time. She says most foragers are careful not to damage the natural environment, so she isn't worried about them disturbing plants or wildlife. Morels, ramps, and greens get tips for how to hunt for wild edibles on our website. And, as always, read more about these news stories at eartheats.org.
Luann Johnson, thanks for the news.
You bet. See you in a week.
Cities throughout the Midwest are full of foodies looking for local food. Farmers in surrounding areas are making inroads in urban markets, but many producers are also trying to grow more food in urban centers. And as city real estate moguls have known for years, in the densely packed urban core, you'll find more space going up rather than spreading out. Harvest Public Media's Peter Gray reports on vertical farming.
Abby Lundrigan leads a tour group through a four-story brick building built in the 1920s. It used to be a meatpacking plant next to the Chicago stockyards.
When we think of a vertical farm here at the plant, what we mean by that is that we're farming in an urban environment, we're farming inside of a building year-round, and we're farming on all floors of that building.
Today, it's still producing food, but the old building has a new glow from grow lights. Farms inside the hulking warehouse use hydroponic technology. They grow plants in a nutrient and water solution instead of soil and use lamps to replace sunlight.
So we grow microgreens up on the fourth floor. We have our aquaponics farm down in the basement. And we have other farms on the floors in between as well.
The Plant Chicago is a nonprofit that provides space to about a dozen local food entrepreneurs. They're mostly small-scale, serving neighborhood farmers markets and restaurants salad greens, baked goods, and kombucha, a bubbly, fermented tea drink. John Adel bought this 94,000-square-foot facility in 2010. It used to produce bacon and ham. Now, it's a local food dream, bringing some of the production closer to the urban area that local foodies call home.
To create those jobs and to grow the food as locally as possible, possible in order to reduce the pollution associated with its transport, the costs associated with its transport, and to keep those dollars here close to home.
Do an internet search for the words vertical and farm. You'll get some very different pictures of the ideal design, some looking downright space age, like something out of the Jetsons cartoon.
The notion that most people have of vertical farming comes from these beautiful renderings of glass skyscrapers in the middle of Manhattan or other big cities.
That idea comes in large part from Dr. Dixon DePommier. He's an ecologist at Columbia University in New York, and he literally wrote the book on vertical farming. He's among futurists who argue that the booming global urban population will make joining ag and city architecture a necessity.
Because I can see the urban landscape parasitizing the rural landscape for its resources.
DePommier says densely populated areas in places like Western Europe, Korea, and Japan could benefit most from his vertical vision.
And instead of spreading out over 318 acres, maybe 3.8 acres, and take those greenhouses and stack them on top of each other, employing the same technologies, you got yourself a vertical farm.
Critics of that vision say vertical farming can't produce the scale of food a growing population will need, at least not without massive amounts of energy and other inputs. Stan Cox is with the Land Institute in Kansas, a group that advocates for environmental and sustainable agriculture issues.
Vertical farming is kind of a vision of factory farming of plants and involves, just like with animals, involves much higher inputs of energy, much higher stress on the plant, and generally is doing things the hard way.
Hydroponic production and using greenhouses to prolong the growing season is already common throughout the country. Vertical farms have sprung up from New York to Houston to Minneapolis. This move to grow more food indoors has also caught on for pharmaceuticals. The Defense Department funded a vertical farm in Texas that grows plants for vaccines and cancer-fighting drugs.
Well, the digester is a very big and complicated project.
Back in Chicago, John Adel is working hard to show critics he can use what is thrown away to power his vertical farm. With a state grant, he's installing a giant metal tank that will convert truckloads of food waste into biogas, burned on site to keep the lights on.
And so we're in the thick of construction now, and I think by the end of this year, everything will be operational and will be well beyond net zero.
But most vertical farming operations today still have a hefty electric bill and carbon footprint. For now, it's not clear if urban vertical farmers will figure out how to produce at an industrial scale, but we do know that farms aren't all white picket fences and red barns anymore, and in the future, they might be in skyscrapers. Peter Gray, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Microbiologist Rachel Dutton started off studying bacterial genetics, but then a growing personal interest in food made her explore food microbiology. Now she's a Bauer Fellow at Harvard. Last week, she talked with us about how the microbes on our feet are awfully similar to the microbes found on some cheeses. Today, Dutton shares information about her research in which she's sequencing, analyzing, and mapping the DNA of organisms found on 160 different cheese rinds.
We are working on our first paper describing the microbial diversity of these 100-plus cheeses. We ended up getting cheeses from about 10 different countries and sequencing the organisms that were present across these cheeses.
Anything that's surprising or unique that you can sort of scoop us?
Yeah. So one interesting thing is that some of these organisms, like I mentioned earlier, look like they're very closely related to things from skin. So that's interesting. The other thing, which is unexpected, is that some of the microbes are closely related to organisms from the ocean, which we didn't really expect to be a common thing, but they're actually on many, many different kinds of cheeses. And so they've really only been described in places like the Arctic Ocean. But we're finding them on cheese. And so the question is, what are they doing there? We don't know how they get there, what they're doing. Are they a big factor in flavor? If you sort of smell a cheese, can you get some of the sort of ocean-y kind of aromas? So that's an unexpected finding. And we found, I think, two species that have never been described on cheese before in some of our cheeses. So we're starting to look at those and what they might be contributing to the cheese.
It's okay. So we'll keep an eye out in another year and a half for the end of this
yes.
project.
Yeah.
All right. The awareness about microbes in general and how they affect our health, specifically our gut microbes, the little bugs that live in our bodies. People are becoming more and more aware that these things are very important. Can you help us understand it in layman terms?
What we're learning is that there are very complex communities of microbes that live everywhere, including in the human body and in the human gut. And researchers now are finding that these microbes play big roles in the amount of energy you get from foods, how much weight you might put on in response to eating different foods, various impacts on your immune system. And so it's just an incredible time in microbiology right now where we are not able to – we're not only able to discover these microbes, which we had really not a good concept of before – but now we're actually starting to understand what they might be doing, and the impacts that they're playing in human health seem to be huge.
If you're eating cheese, will the microbes on cheese affect the microbes in my body?
Yeah. So we just published a study in collaboration with a lab that studies the gut microbiome. And we had 10 study subjects, eat cheese as well as other fermented foods. On one of the diets, and we watched what happened to the microbes. And we saw that some of the microbes from cheese can actually survive the gut. So we don't know at this point if they're doing anything to the community in the gut, but we know that they're there. They're active. They're alive. So I think it's, you know, completely open question. And it's not that different than thinking about probiotics from yogurt, other fermented foods that people have started to work on.
So far, we've gotten away from really enjoying cheese and talking about the pleasure of food. So when you're doing all this amazing research, are you tasting any of this stuff by chance?
Absolutely. part of what drew me into studying cheese microbiology is just a passion for food. And so we work with a lot of cheesemakers. So we'll go visit farms and sample cheeses. And I worked for 2 months with a cheesemaker making cheese before I started my lab to get direct experience with the thing I was going to be studying. And so I've had a lot of wonderful opportunities to travel and experience cheeses. And mostly we work with small producers. So it's so many interesting stories and people who are really passionate about what they're doing and producing amazing cheeses.
Describe just the basic cheese-making process, if you can.
Yeah. So it's really – maybe I'm biased because I'm a microbiologist, but a lot of it has to do with microbes. So you start with milk, which can usually come from a cow or a goat or a sheep. And then what you do is, similar to yogurt, you add microbes so that the milk is fermented. So the cheesemaker will warm up the milk, so it's a nice warm environment for the microbes to grow. Those microbes will start to ferment the sugar in the milk, produce acid, which starts to coagulate the milk. Usually rennet, an enzyme, is added to help that process. And then you end up with curds, which is the solids separating from the whey. So you have your curds and whey. And the curds are fresh cheese. So that's something like a fresh chèvre that you would have, something very simple, very milky, kind of tart taste. The process that we study is what happens next, which is when you age cheese. So cheeses can be aged for weeks or months or years, depending on what kind of cheese you make. And during that process, a whole other set of microbes colonize the surface of the cheese. So that's what's called the rind. So if you think about on the surface of a piece of brie, for example, you have this white fluffy surface. That's actually a microbial community that grows on the surface. And those microbes colonize the surface. They form this what's called a biofilm, so this sort of surface community on the cheese, and they're actually imparting a lot of the flavor during the aging process. So you start out with a fresh cheese, and then you end up with these hundreds of varieties of cheese. And a lot of that has to do with the microbes that are growing on the surface. So what types of microbes, how much you have, that can all impact the flavor of the final cheese.
Let's back up in this process. Yeah. Cheese starts with milk.
Yes.
Are you noticing a difference in the microbial makeup of cheese that comes from milk from animals that have been fed antibiotics, from animals that have been raised organically?
Right. So with cheese making, you're not you can't make cheese from milk that has antibiotics in it because it'll kill the bacteria that you're trying to grow in order to make the cheese. So when cheesemakers, if they have to treat a sick cow with antibiotics, they take that cow out of the pool of milk that they would use. In terms of what they're eating, it can have a really big impact on what the cheese tastes like. So cows that are eating grass, the flavors and the vitamins, the nutrients from the grass actually come through to the milk. And so you'll have cheeses that have a little bit more of a yellow-orange color to them. And those are from beta-carotenes pigments in the grass that actually come through the milk. So traditionally, yellow cheeses were cheeses that were made in the summer when the animals were out on pasture. And cheeses made in the winter were lighter color. Cheesemakers for the past over 100 years ago started adding dyes, you know, like annatto, natural food dyes, to make the cheeses more yellow so it would look more like that really high-quality grass-fed milk.
And now we come back to this concept of terroir.
Yes.
Again. So raw cheese, can we talk about that as
yeah.
well? Do you notice a difference there?
So there hasn't been that much research on the differences in terms of the, you know, very controlled experiments of raw versus pasteurized cheese. So normally with milk, when it comes directly out of the animal in its raw form, it has a number of microbes that are already present in the milk. And so we can look and see, you know, what the microbial population is before pasteurization and after pasteurization. Pasteurization gets rid of a lot of those microbes. And so the idea is that if you have more microbial diversity in your milk, because the microbes are what are impacting the flavor to a great extent, maybe you have more complex flavors in the cheese that are made from raw milk. And I think that that can be true, but I don't think that's to say that you can't make delicious cheese with pasteurized milk, because there are. And we're not seeing a huge difference in the rind, but I think inside the cheese there can be quite a bit of a difference in terms of which microbes are present in the cheese.
Okay, let's have a little fun. You're on a desert island. You can only have one cheese. What cheese are you taking with you?
Well, I probably would take Cabot Cloth Bound. So Cabot Creamery, which is a big cheddar producer in Vermont. So they wanted to make a traditional English-style cloth-bound cheddar. And so they're making this cheddar and aging it in a very traditional way for about a year in a cave. And the flavors you end up getting in that cheese are absolutely incredible. So very caramelly. So you get these little crunchy crystals. It's
Cabot Cloth Bound Cheddar.
Cabot Cloth Bound Cheddar, yeah.
Okay, check that out.
It's a great everyday cheese.
Dr. Rachel Dutton is a Bauer Fellow at Harvard University, where she works with cheese and its microbes. It's been so great having you here. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
There's more to this conversation with Dr. Rachel Dutton. Listen to the whole thing at eartheats.org. Coming up, carrots at the market and then carrots in the kitchen.
And you could cut, these can be fairly roughly cut, kind of peasant style. It's all going to kind of cook into one another and become kind of like a fruit compote.
Kind of. It has apples and sweet potatoes as well as honey and a bunch of spices. Daniel Orr whips together Zimus.
Let's eat carrots together until...
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. Bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
There's so many different varieties of carrots. You know, you can get gigantic carrots or baby carrots. Some carrots, you harvest early, 36 days for baby carrots. You let them grow a little longer for bigger carrots.
Jim Lewis of Old Post Gardens is showing off his products at today's farmer's market. He planted these beautiful carrots several months ago in the fall. They stayed in the ground all the while until he harvested them just a couple weeks ago, resulting in some mighty fine carrots.
Carrots over winter actually taste better. It's just the way carrots are. That's the way they mature. The starches over the winter turn into sugars.
He's optimistic he'll be able to bring carrots to market for several more weeks.
Hopefully all summer. Of course, they're not quite as good during the summer, but, you know, carrots are good for you.
We took some fun pictures at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market. Find them on our Flickr page. Search for Earth Eats. Now, Chef Daniel Orr will cook with carrots. Tzimmus is a traditional Jewish stew with carrots and apples and sweet potatoes. This is typically eaten around Rosh Hashanah, but we're doing it in early spring because, well, carrots. But also sweet potatoes are still available at the market.
So what we have is a lot of different root vegetables that we're going to be adding some different ingredients to. I've got a pot going here. Now, there's several different ways you could do this. You could layer it in a baking dish and then put the liquids over it and let it slowly bake. But I'm usually a little bit more pressed for time than that. So we're just going to throw this all in a hot pan. Okay, I've got some orange juice. Now I'm going to throw in some sweet potatoes, some carrots, and you could cut, these can be fairly roughly cut, kind of peasant style. It's all going to kind of cook into one another and become kind of like a fruit compote. You don't, it's not really a side vegetable because it's very rich and very full of flavor. Now I'm adding some dried fruit. Got some, you could do prunes, or I'm using figs today, and some dried apricots. Okay, now we're going to add some spices. We've got some fresh orange peel. We've got some honey, which is going to give us our sweetener. Okay, we've got a little bit of brown sugar. Okay, I'm going to add about a cup of water there, and we're just going to bring that up to a boil, cook it until everything's nice and tender, and that will be our tzimmus.
Find the recipe for this at eartheats.org.
This is great training ground for young people. As you can see, young people are gravitating toward this type of farming rather than going out in a rural community and when it's 30 degrees and you're pulling carrots out of the ground in October. You know, it's snowing, it's raining, the wind is at 35 miles an hour. I don't think that's so attractive to young people.
We heard about an innovative food system in urban Chicago in the first part of the show. Much of what happens agriculturally in urban areas today can be traced back in one way or another to Will Allen and his work with Growing Power in Milwaukee. He tours the country speaking with various food and farm groups, including students. Lauren Glapa sat in on his visit to Indiana University earlier this month.
But aquaponics and being able to farm like this and being able to farm in a communal setting with others is because it's pretty lonely out on a farm if you're row cropping or working by yourself. That's not a very fun way of working. So I think this form of agriculture is something that's here to stay.
Will Allen is an urban farmer based in Milwaukee. Allen is now the CEO of Growing Power, a company that builds community food systems, systems that provide local and affordable food for residents in the community. In his talk to students and community members at Indiana University's Hilltop Garden and Nature Center, Allen talked about the simplicity and sustainability of small aquaponics operations. Allen's company, Growing Power, uses aquaponics, the method of growing crops and fish together in a recirculating system, to grow tilapia, yellow perch, and various greens. Afterwards, Allen toured and critiqued the Hilltop Garden Center's gardens and greenhouses.
Yeah, I would just add some compost, because your beds are really nice. What's happening here is I see all over the country in terms of student gardens like this. I like this one because they follow some of the principles that I use in terms of the raised beds. You want to get away from excessive moisture. We're having a lot of flooding issues, and this is one way for us to get away from the flooding issues by raising up.
Audrey Brinkers, an IU campus garden coordinator, attended Allen's talk and garden tour.
I think it's definitely good for a lot of our members who see gardening on campus but don't really see that as part of a broader community or any sort of broader community change. And so having someone here to talk about how it could have real effects and lasting effects and broad effects rather than just students growing food for themselves and for a couple of dining facilities, I think is definitely an inspiration for a lot of people coming out.
Farming inside cities is nothing new. I mean, it's been done in Europe and Africa and countries like that forever. People have been growing food inside cities. The best case scenario is for people to grow this in their backyard, maybe on a smaller scale, but the same concept of being able to raise a percentage of their own food using these kind of methods by not using chemicals.
I almost was a student here, but wow. Campus was a little bit too long. And I love that Miami weather. Yeah.
For Earth Eats, I'm Lauren Galapa.
Will Allen of Growing Power speaking with students at Indiana University. A longer cut of that interview at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Tara Cobb, Lauren Galapa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Another week of local sustainable food in the books. Thanks for being here. I'm Annie Corrigan.